Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like to welcome now Bill Burke White. He is a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania, and he is our foreign correspondent. Welcome, Bill, to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be with you, as always.
It's great to have you on the air. Now, usually you and I talk about foreign countries or regions in the world and what's going on there. And today we're talking about something that covers all regions in the world, namely the supply and price of water, food, and oil, and the implications of those things on foreign policy. We've seen dramatic rises in food and oil prices this year, and there's much discussion about changes in rainfall patterns due to climate change. And here in the Southwest, we have a situation that's not unique in the world, unfortunately, which is that people take water out of the earth at a faster rate than it can be replenished. Food, water, and oil, those are the things that that keep us going. How do we think about them? How do you think about them in from a foreign policy perspective?
Well, I think we have all felt some of these changes. You know, try to fill up your tank of gas or much less be an airline and try to fill up an airplane's tank of gas, and we've seen the prices go up dramatically. And most of the stories that we've read about in the newspapers or see on the evening news are about the hardships that's creating for Americans and others just trying to live their daily lives. What has not gotten much attention is how the pricing and potential shortages of all three of these resources are really impacting foreign policy in some very profound and important ways. Namely, the possibilities going forward for conflict in the world are changing dramatically. It used to be that conflicts might arise for political reasons or perhaps a dispute over territory, but what we're starting to see is that there's meaningful prospect that the next 20 or 50 years of conflict in the world will be driven by these three resources, oil, food, and water. And it doesn't take too much effort to look in countries, whether it's China or sub-Saharan Africa, and realize that there are dramatic shortages and rapidly increasing prices of the basic commodities of life, energy, food, and water. And in fact, these three commodities are deeply linked together, in a sense. And so I hope what we can chat a little bit about today is how those linkages sort of happen and what it means for foreign policy. And I guess the place to start might actually be oil, because that's the one that's on most people's minds and perhaps the one that we're most familiar with.
Well, I have to interrupt you and say we don't have to look into the future to see wars fought over oil.
Oil is one that obviously wars have been fought over, and if you look at the Iraq war that we have found ourselves still embroiled in 6 years later, oil is certainly a part of that. But imagine this for a moment, right? It's one thing what we've just seen in Iraq, but imagine a situation where China, which is now the world's second largest energy user, realizes that it either cannot afford or cannot get access to enough oil and other energy. At which point, you could see, for example, the Chinese looking around saying, "Where is their oil?" And what they have been doing lately is sort of getting very chummy with evil, if I may say so, African governments, take the government of Zimbabwe, for example, that may have resources and trying to sort of lock in energy contracts. But if you take that to another step, where you might see things go next is the Chinese look down toward the East Timor gap, this area between East Timor and Australia that has some of the world's biggest supplies of natural gas. And you might see the Chinese start to look at that as an energy supply and perhaps even look at it militarily as an energy supply. So you suddenly go from the United States essentially saying we want to make sure that energy isn't in the hands of Saddam Hussein and evil dictators to a world in which the United States, China, and other sort of world great powers, India being one of them, are are starting to think about using their military to actually grab hold of and keep those oil and energy resources. And we're certainly not at this peak oil yet, this idea that oil will eventually will start having diminishing supplies. What instead we're seeing is just rising demand and speculation on the price of oil. But when you get to a point of peak oil or something close to that, it's very likely that we'll actually see wars fought over territory where that oil is contained. And that's, I think, a very scary prospect for a world in which we've seen far too much conflict over oil already.
Well, I know that human behavior isn't rational, but it seems like when you have the prospect of the depletion and eventually the virtual end of what is a limited resource, and that you have the potential for wars being fought over this limited resource, and when you have the knowledge that burning it creates carbon dioxide and global warming, which is going to do us in one way or another anyhow, why do resources that would be fought for, you know, they'll be used for fighting wars and even for drilling oil, why are they not used into the cultivation of, you know, large-scale solar energy infrastructures and other kinds of renewable energy?
Well, one surprising thing here is that some of the effort in terms of finding alternative energy sources has gone into things like maize, corn, and other sort of things that one can grow and use as energy. And that's been somewhat useful in shifting some energy demand, but it leads to another set of problems, and that's where we start to see the linkages between these three urgently needed things, energy, oil, energy, food and water, because as soon as you start using corn to fuel automobiles or other things that burn energy, you see corn being more expensive to use as food, because those are essentially fungible commodities. You can either use the corn to eat or you can use it to fuel your car. And if we're starting to use corn and other such things that we're growing in as an energy alternative, it's going to drive up the price of food. And if you start to grow and cultivate more crops to use as energy, that also uses more water. And so it's not so easy to say, oh, let's just shift to other kinds of supply of energy, because doing so may actually exacerbate the costs of food or the costs of an availability of water. Now, solar is a great resource because you don't have that problem with solar. It does take some water and some energy to make the solar panels, but solar is one form of energy that we ought to be shifting more to because it doesn't create burdens on the food and water supply. So in some ways, the approach that has been predominant so far, at least in the United States, of shifting to these kinds of renewable vegetable sources of energy may in fact end up being highly counterproductive as the price of food increases and water availability shrinks. So we ought to be looking much more at things like solar. And particularly the developing world needs to be doing that. If you go to a country in, say, sub-Saharan Africa, they tend to have even more dramatic water scarcity than we have. They also tend to have less ability to pay higher prices for food. And so in a place, you know, whether it's Uganda or South Africa or particularly some of the desert countries where sunlight is readily available, they're the ones that need to be making these shifts first. It's expensive to make the shift, but in the long term, they will be far better off because they'll break out of this kind of catch-22 of shifting from one source of energy to another, but that ends up burdening the food production and water supply.
I was reading an article in preparation for our conversation today in which it was talking about how when a developing country becomes a bit more prosperous, like China, more people start eating meat, and then more grains go to feeding cattle for meat, and then those grains don't get used for human consumption. So that's another factor that influences the supply of food.
Yeah, if you look at sort of, you know, our eating patterns, the least energy and water demanding kinds of food to eat are vegetables, things that simply grow. And then as you go higher up the food chain to things like chicken or beef, it takes a great deal more, sometimes much as four or five times as much energy and water to produce that food. And as countries have become richer, and China is obviously the most glaring example of this, the energy demands and water demands to produce steak dinners for people in China are extraordinary. And so it's simply adding fuel to the fire, if you will, when you see, you know, 10,000 new cars a day on the streets of Beijing and restaurants opening serving steak that may well be being grown in Brazil, where the rainforest was just cut to grow it, and then put on a plane that's burning up energy as well to fly that to Beijing. It's not surprising that this vicious cycle simply gets worse and worse, because each step in that has had a huge energy drain and huge environmental consequences. So as people have become better off, the demands of a sort of better lifestyle that we've become accustomed to in the United States just put extraordinary tax on the environment and demands on the resource cycle that we're talking about.
We're talking to foreign correspondent Bill Burke-White. It's interesting. We talked the other day on this program about new methods or alternative methods of ranching that are far more efficient and that help help with river restoration and the restoration of open space, where the grass grows actually better if cattle are herded a certain way. And things like that, which have thus far, and many, many other things like that, which have thus far sort of been relegated into the kind of niche of do-goody environmentalism, suddenly become much more closely related to foreign policy. In other words, if people use methods of farming and ranching which are much better for the land, that doesn't just affect the profitability of the rancher, that affects everybody.
Well, let's take an example so that come from the area of water, which is an area that here in Pennsylvania we don't worry about so much. You may worry about it a lot more out in the Southwest. But take, for example, the statements by the Egyptian government made very recently that if any countries start diverting water from the Nile, that Egypt will respond perhaps militarily. The Nile starts to flow in parts of Uganda, flows north, passes through Sudan, and ultimately ends up in Egypt. And Egypt needs that water desperately for both the, you know, drinking water, but more importantly for them, maybe not more importantly, but equally importantly, for agricultural purposes. And if there's not enough water in the Nile, the Egyptians can't eat. So for them, it becomes an extraordinary threat if Sudan starts to divert some of those water resources. So figuring out ways to farm more efficiently becomes a foreign policy goal and perhaps an important development goal for the United States, rather than simply giving Egypt, which is one of the largest two foreign aid recipients of the United States, money, making sure that they're figuring out ways to engage in agricultural practices that preserve the water flow in the Nile is extraordinarily important. And if we think about water a little bit more generally, the world doesn't lose water. We have a sort of certain set amount of water in the world. The problems are about whether it's usable water and whether where that water is. So when water comes down as rain, we can capture it, and some of it goes into the aquifer and will be available for drinking later on. Other water washes off and ends up back in the ocean as salinated water, which we can't use very well. And what we're seeing now is fights about who controls that water. And there, perhaps the most extraordinary example is China and Tibet. We always are hearing about the human rights violations and issues that arise in Tibet. And one reason for that we've not ever really talked about or thought about is the extraordinary water supply in the glaciers of the Himalayan mountains that end up washing into all of the key rivers in China. And so if you want to figure out how to deal with the conflict in Tibet, that, you've got to deal with water resources there and water scarcity in China. And so, again, thinking about U.S. foreign policy and Chinese foreign and domestic policy, suddenly figuring out where that water is going to come from becomes a really important part of thinking about our foreign policy stance toward China, Tibet, Nepal, and that whole region. And this is something that the U.S. State Department has traditionally not had on the agenda, but may come to the very forefront of a foreign policy of the new administration.
We're talking to foreign correspondent Bill Burke-White. There's also issues that become very important, which is what happens when you pollute your rivers, what happens when you don't encourage water conservation, or if you are able to keep your rivers clean and really control the chemical pollution that goes in them, and you're able to encourage people to conserve water, then maybe problems like China and Tibet become a little bit less aggressive.
Absolutely. I mean, if the Yangtze and the Nile flowed with clean water, there would be a lot less concern about the supply of it, because you can't use much of the water that's there. So figuring out ways of not polluting, and the Chinese have the biggest problem here because it's cheaper to dump the chemicals in the river than it is to deal with them, and then you get polluted water, which you can't use. And then the where the cycle comes back to energy is that in cleaning up that water or in desalinating water that comes out of the ocean is a highly energy-intensive process, right? If you want to take the salt out of water in the ocean, you essentially need to boil it, evaporate the salt out, and boiling that water takes energy. So if you've got dirty water, whether it's with chemicals or naturally dirty with salt, to get clean water takes energy, and that puts more demand back on the energy side. So all of these are deeply linked together, but that it pushes environmentalism and environmental protection from simply a kind of matter of altruism, which was where it probably was 10 years ago, to really the forefront of our foreign policy. In other words, we need to be making sure that countries in the developing world aren't poisoning their water supplies if we want to make sure that they don't end up engaged in a conflict over the remaining tracts of free and clean water out there. Perhaps the largest, one of the largest supplies, I think it is in fact the largest supply of fresh water in the world, is Lake Baikal in the middle of Siberia. It's not that far from China, and you could imagine a circumstance where the Chinese and the Russians start to conflict with one another over flow of water out of Lake Baikal. We want to prevent those kind of military conflicts, and to do so, one needs to make sure that the Chinese and the Russians both have very good pollution controls and usage of water in a way that's the most environmentally friendly possible. So it changes the very nature of environmentalism from kind of a side issue to the forefront of U.S. foreign policy.
There's another issue that comes up with all of this, and that is whether water is a human right and what happens when water is privatized, which we have seen. I mean, I read a bunch of articles about food, water, and oil yesterday, preparing to talk about this, and one of them was in a financial newspaper. It was talking about future water shortages and then recommending that people invest in various kinds of water treatment and water filtration and basically all sorts of things surrounding the privatization of water.
So if we start with the kind of idea of basic human rights and we look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, for example, it doesn't list water as a human right, but it talks about a number of basic things for which we need water, including, the right to life. Without water, we can't live. Our bodies are mostly water. And so it's very easy to make an argument that having access to water is a fundamental human right. The problem with that is that if water is free and is simply thought of as everywhere and available, it becomes very hard to keep people from polluting it or misusing it. If water's free and we can use it to water our big lot of green grass in the middle of the desert, it is not efficient or effective. And so people talk about privatization or commoditization of water, in fact, as a way of controlling its use and making sure it's being used efficiently. If you have to pay for water, you might choose to have a rock garden in the middle of the desert rather than a big patch of green grass. And I think most of us would agree that the rock garden makes more sense there. The problem is, if you start to price water, you price people out of water and price them out of life, in a sense. So it's about figuring out how do you make sure that for basic human need, water is available and free, but for certain kinds of what we might say are luxuries, like watering your garden, or commercial uses, that water is not free. And figuring out how you do that, how you privatize water partly but not completely, is critical. Because what you would like to do is say, okay, there's a great deal of water in Canada. It's got about 25% of the world's water supply. So heavily water-dependent industries might make sense to have in Canada, because water ought to be cheaper there than it is, say, in the deserts of the American Southwest. So you want to use the market to try to regulate where those industries are, but you don't want someone in sub-Saharan Africa not to be able to buy a glass of water that they need to drink. And so it's both a moral and an economic problem coming together all at once.
When we're talking about Canada, apparently Canada has been having internal discussions about making sure that water is kept out of the North American Free Trade Agreement.
So that takes us, and without making it a lecture on the international law of water, let me just say a couple words about water is already in some ways privatized, because it to some degree belongs to the country where it's found. Water that is located in the ground underneath a country belongs to that country, in a sense. And water that flows in rivers belongs to the country it's passing through, but that country has duties not to use all of the water passing through, such that countries lower down on the flow of the water still get access to it. Canada's concern is that the North American Free Trade Agreement essentially says that there should be a free passage and free movement of goods between countries, and Canada doesn't want to lose all of its water to the United States. The American Southwest, with no offense intended to Southern California, could drink up and water the grass of quite a lot of houses in the Los Angeles basin, and tap right into that Canadian water if it were completely included within, say, the NAFTA or WTO agreements. And so Canada is trying to protect its own resources, or at least get compensated for the use of the water that's sitting in Canada. And in a funny turn of events, the global warming problem doesn't really solve this. On one hand, you might say, well, if we just melt the glaciers, there'll be more water. In fact, it exacerbates the problem, because those glaciers run off into the oceans, and you end up with salinated waters, rather than kind of controlled flow every year as water freezes and defrosts in, say, the Canadian Rockies. And so Canada's looking at a booming demand from the United States trying to siphon water down, and then lower or smaller glacial reserves as well. So countries like Canada and places like Tibet are realizing that they have a very valuable resource that they don't want to lose, either through global warming or through downstream demand from other parts of China or the American Southwest.
Well, I think it's also important to point out that when glaciers melt through climate change, they don't come back. So once they're gone, they're a non-renewable resource, much like oil.
Right. They're now sitting as salinated water in the ocean. And we're getting much better at using salinated water. Many places in the Middle East now have figured out that if you have enough salt, it takes a lot of energy to get the salt out. If you've got enough sunlight, you can build desalination plants that rely on solar energy. And that's about the only effective and efficient way to take the salt out of that water. But once it melts, it becomes unusable until you can get the salt out of it and bring it back into the fresh water supply.
We're talking to Bill Burke-White. Another thing that has not yet made an entry into foreign policy discussions, but nevertheless probably will, is drip irrigation, which is just vastly more efficient than flood irrigation, though flood irrigation is what a lot of people still use.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, one thing in the United States to make that transition. But again, let's move the discussion to, say, the developing world, somewhere in Southeast Asia, where farmers just don't have the resources necessarily to invest in new irrigation systems. So if you're using flood irrigation, you're wasting water and wasting energy because oftentimes you're pumping that water to flood the fields and, again, exacerbating all of the problems we're talking about. So if you say, what should the United States be doing? Not only should we be making sure that we're effectively irrigating our own crops, but saying that the USAID, the Agency for International Development, needs to make sure that part of our foreign policy and development packages toward many countries in the developing world includes things like making sure they're moving toward drip irrigation, because that will, you know, relieve some of the burden that we're seeing on the energy, water and food supply, and if you don't do it, it pushes you closer to the kind of conflict that we're trying to avoid, or even closer to things like the genocide in Darfur that some have argued is in part due to water shortages in Sudan. So all of these things end up being deeply interconnected, and the United States needs to prioritize all of those conservation mechanisms in our foreign policy in order to try to avert conflict as well as preserve our own access to resources.
It seems like pretty much the only unlimited resource that we have at this point is solar energy, because there's just, it just keeps coming. There's no shortage of it, and never will be in human history and the human future. But we have a certain amount of arable land on the planet. We have a certain amount of fresh water on the planet. We have a certain amount of oil. We also have, which we haven't even factored into the discussion, a growing world population. Talk about the population and also the encouraging or lack thereof of family planning in this whole conversation.
Yeah, it's the question of population is an extraordinary one, because the world population continues to increase. The increases occur most in the countries that are relatively poor, but increasing in wealth to some degree, and that are also graduating, shall I say, into higher lifestyles. And the closer you live to the land, the less resources you use. So in a place like China, which is becoming richer, you have a vastly growing population demanding many more resources. And resources aren't movable very easily, right? There may be plenty of water around the world for everybody, but if the water's sitting in Canada, it's kind of hard to drink it in Beijing. And so the population problem is not just the growing numbers, but their location and the growing demand of that enlarging population for a better lifestyle. So you've got a situation that each part just compounds itself. And then, the question about family planning is a very interesting one. I was just back in China last week talking with people who were talking about their sisters. And I'm like, how do you have a sister? There's a number of people in China who have figured out ways around the family planning restrictions, and there are ways of paying fines to get around it. But that also brings you back to the human rights question. Do we have a right to water? Do we have a right to procreate and have more than one child? So if you start imposing family planning restrictions in response to resource constraints, does that interfere with people's basic human rights to a family and family life? So it's not an easy solution simply to say we're going to limit the numbers of people. But what I do think we need to do is start limiting the way people are, all of us included, use resources. What kinds of resources we use, when and how we use them. And the one benefit, if one can find a benefit in the rising price of energy, is it starts making us ask, well, do we want to organize ourselves in ways that we're burning through lots of gallons of gas every day? Or is it better to try to organize one's life to be slightly closer to the land and what we eat, closer to our jobs and where we live, and so forth? And that's not easy for everyone, but particularly in the developing world, where we're still sort of figuring out how to organize our lifestyles, or people there are saying, do we live in big cities? Do we live more rurally? That taking those factors into account is going to be an urgent necessity.
The kind of conversation that we're having right now, is this taking place in foreign policy circles?
It is starting to. It was not on the radar screen of the United States government for many, many years. In the Clinton administration, a new position was created in the State Department called Undersecretary for Global Affairs. The former Senator Tim Worth was the first person to hold that position. And that position was really one that was intended to think about these kind of global cross-cutting issues. I have to say, early on in the Clinton administration, the position was not a powerful one in the State Department. I think that is starting to change. There's also an office in the State Department called the Office of Policy Planning that's supposed to be doing kind of long-term thinking about what are the problems not of today but of the next decade or next 50 years. And these are the kinds of things that are being thought about now in places like the Office of Policy Planning, asking, you know, how do you deal with growing energy demand, or how do you deal with water supplies? So we're starting to get there, but it's still a long way from being the number one priority on the White House agenda. My argument is that it needs to be one of those very top priorities. You're never going to solve, for example, the conflict between Israel and Palestine if you can't figure out water supply to the communities in Gaza and in the West Bank. So all of these things have to get thought about strategically as well as environmentally, and we're moving in that direction. But I think we're going to have to see the development of international law in this area to much more carefully regulate the cross-border flows of water where you have rivers that cross multiple borders. You're going to have to see states engaging one another in talking about water use and even food supplies, and much more cooperation, because we can improve things in the United States, but if things don't improve in China, it doesn't matter much that they improved here. So you need to deal with these problems globally, not just locally. And the U.S. is just beginning to get there. It is my hope that a new president, and I think it's more likely under an Obama presidency, would bump these issues up very high on the agenda going forward.
Bill Burke White is our foreign correspondent. He's a professor of international law at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
It is my pleasure to talk to you, and I wish you a very good day.
Thank you so much, and we will probably talk to you next month.
I look forward to it.
We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Stay tuned to KSFR, the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. I'd like to welcome Brother Brian Dabosky, who is a Christian brother at the College of Santa Fe and the president of the Santa Fe Institute for Spirituality, and Bill O'Donnell, who is a board and staff member of the Santa Fe Institute for Spirituality, and he's also the producer and host of Spirituality TV on cable channel 16. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, very sure. Good to be here.
Great to have you both back. It's been quite a while. You have a program going on this week, Brother Brian, about St. John of the Cross and what St. John of the Cross can do for us today. He's a mystic of the 16th century, I believe.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he lived during the 1500s, but he because he was down to what was really happening, he's applicable anytime, any place.
Tell us about his life and his teachings.
Yeah, he was a very young Carmelite priest when Teresa of Avila discovered him, found out what a very holy man he was, how much he knew about the spiritual life, and took him as her advisor, even though she was 25 years older than he and had a lot more experience in doing things for the Carmelites.
And so the course that you're teaching is called Love Transforms Suffering. How did tell us about his life and how love transformed his suffering? He did quite a lot of suffering.
Oh, he did. Yes, indeed. He was very much in trouble with his attempts to reform the men Carmelites because they were taking life easy. And he wanted them to go back to a life of prayer and fasting so that they could be of assistance to other people. See, you can't do that unless you take something out of your own hide. And when they were taking it easy, then they were disobeying the whole purpose of being Carmelite.
So it was a kind of decadent period in monastic history?
Right. Definitely.
So they were lounging on leather sofas and having good food and
eating three times a day instead of once.
Which is probably more than the people who are putting money into their collection plate were doing.
For sure, yeah. Right. So what he did was to bring them back to the original rule. And they resisted that. In fact, they even put him in prison, and he suffered quite a bit from that because he was in a tiny cell that was barely big enough for him, and he was just barely 5 feet tall. So with all of that suffering, he was able to get through to the suffering of Christ and to recognize how that brings life to everyone. So he, in his suffering, was able to identify with Christ, and that's why he changed his name from John of St. Matthew to John of the Cross, because of all that suffering.
And amazing that the church itself put him through it.
Right. Well, it was members of his congregation. The other people who were taking care of the church, like bishops, recognized his sanctity and tried to help him out. And the same was true for other people in the Carmelite order, like the folks who were outside of Spain. They were very much in favor of his reformation.
And so Juan de la Cruz, St. John of the Cross, left a lot of poetry, and he also left us the term the dark night of the soul.
Right. Yeah, and it was in this process of getting close to God that we have to leave behind the false gods, like I'm a pretty important person, and that everything that I sense is vital. And once a person learns that those things don't really count, then that person would go through the dark night of the senses, so that this person is no longer trying to fill up with things that are disappointing. And that is the preparation for the dark night of the soul, where the person now goes through a cleansing of all ideas, concepts, you know, my baby, the thing I figured out, right? And this is a lot harder to do without.
So it's really like the process of meditation leading to egolessness.
Yeah, right. And you see what the people mean in the Eastern format by egolessness is what the people in the West call getting rid of the false self. See, what the Easterners call the ego is what John of the Cross would call an imaginary or a false self. The self that I dream up, you know, particularly when I'm a teenager. And then I try to live up to this, and it causes me a great deal of trouble. But eventually, when I can get rid of this mistake, then I can discover my true self.
Now, you are teaching, there's a class that goes Monday through Friday this week, I guess yesterday through this coming Friday. Mm-hmm. What will you be teaching in the class? What are you teaching?
Yeah. Well, it works from Sunday night, actually, all through Thursday night as well. So people who are working and don't have time off in the morning can come to whatever they can attend of that. But I will have 15 sessions, and all of these sessions will be about different things. So each of the hours is devoted to a different topic.
Relating to John of the Cross.
Right. And it's all about how he used suffering to become a full person. And when he did this kind of thing, what John of the Cross did was totally interior. Therefore, there wouldn't be any way to say it. But he found a way to express these things in poetry. So
right.
We're going to go over the poetry in Spanish, and then we'll take a look at the English translations. In fact, for that first poem we deal with, we have about 5 different English translations. And in the process of doing that, we catch on to his symbols. We will begin to see the way in which you can provide a visual image of something that has no visual aspect, like God. See, having no surface, there isn't any light bouncing off, and there wouldn't be anything you could see. But you can pick something that looks very good in nature, and since God created it, then that would be a symbol for the uncreated vision.
And so then you contemplate things in nature?
Sure, yeah. And you see, that's what he does mostly. He talks about the things which are most important to people, like water. See, in the western part of...
That's what we just talked about in the last segment.
Yeah. And in the western part of Spain, it looks very much like New Mexico. That's one of the reasons why the people from Spain were very much at home here. And what happens there is that water is at a premium, so people can get very thirsty. And then when they get to the water, it is so refreshing you know, that it's much better in that sense than wine. So that's what he does. He uses the symbol water in order to show us how we can get closer to God, how God is really pursuing us. And his famous poem is, "How Well I Know the Spring That Flowed."
Now, was it both of you who did a pilgrimage recently?
Right.
Bill O'Donnell, tell us about that.
Well, we just got back the first week of June, and it was my first time to Rome. And we went to Rome and experienced some of the grandeur of the Eternal City. I mean, there were amazing churches there, and it really made you stop and think, you know, why did they put so much effort and so much art history and just majesty in these churches? And it's still working on me, I can tell you that.
What does the pilgrimage mean for you, Brother Brian, as a Catholic brother?
Mm-hmm. Well, what it meant was an opportunity to get back to those people who suffered and who died for Christ. And you see, the main people that we studied would be Peter and Paul, who gave their lives there during the persecution of Nero around the year 60, 68. So what we did was to follow first century martyrs, people who in pursuing Christ ran into the trouble that the emperor wanted them to worship him and a bunch of other false gods. So when they refused to do that, he killed them to make an example for them. That's why it was Lions 48, Christians 0 in the Colosseum.
It's funny, when you go to Rome and you think about the roots of Christianity, maybe it's the same thing that plays out in every century in any number of religions, which is there are humble and poor roots, and then they grow into these lavish, wealthy, rich, gold-covered, and often really decadent and corrupt systems, and then they have reformations and they clean themselves out again. When I've been to Rome, I could never feel the aspect of humility and poverty there.
Well, you should go to the Colosseum itself, right, and see the area in which they died, and also to the catacombs. Did you visit the catacombs? All right. Well, there are about 26 of them. The smallest one is 5 kilometers long. And when you go down there, see, there isn't any opulence, right? And there you are in touch with the slaves. Most of them, say 95% of the early Christians, were slaves because they could be spiritually free by accepting the message of Christ.
But both of the things you talk about are not churches.
Well, they are churches. In fact, they were the first churches. Yeah.
Well,
it was consecrated by the blood of the martyrs.
But it's not where people go to practice and where the priests give sermons and so on.
Oh, it is. Yeah, they do that in Rome. And they have masses regularly at the Colosseum. And you've probably seen it on television. That's where they do the Stations of the Cross for Friday, Good Friday of Holy Week. So you see, the people who are sort of tuned into it, they do these things. Now, what you're saying is true, that the Colosseum is not itself a church, but the catacombs are, and their regular mass is said there. In fact, when we went to the catacomb of St. Calixtus, we saw a place that was set up for a mass that was going to happen in a little while. You see, that's where we got the idea of, since we can't do the masses down there where they used to do them, right on the new grave of a new martyr, we're going to take a piece of the martyr and bring it to Santa Fe. And that's what we do, is that every church has at least one part of a martyr there.
When you say part of a martyr, what do you mean?
A piece of his bone, or maybe a piece of flesh if it's incorrupt, that sort of thing.
So actual relics.
Yeah.
So let's talk for a moment about the Santa Fe Institute for Spirituality, because that is what's sponsoring the series that you're doing this week, and also a lot of other events and teachers who are teaching as well. Bill, you want to talk about the?
Yeah, well, after Brother Brian does his week on John of the Cross, and I would like to say his style of teaching, and I'm a former teacher myself, is extraordinary. He says he's going to give 15 hours, and he means it. And for every hour of teaching, he gives you a 2-page handout with all the relevant points that he's going to express. So, for instance, most people can't get there for all those times. And so then they won't miss anything, in a sense, because all those things will be accounted for, and they can come and catch up right where they are. And that's an extraordinary way to teach. So he has a great – and it's also very interactive. He'll answer all your questions. There'll be time for that, and what the thoughts are that come up in your own life. So it makes it really relevant for today. So I would encourage everybody to come out whenever they can during that period of time. And then the following week, the Reverend Bob Patterson is going to open up that whole area on a Saturday. It's the following Saturday after Brian's week on Martin Luther. And his relationship with the popes, as you can imagine, was a little strained. But the truth of that...
A little strained indeed.
Yeah, will come out, hopefully. And then the following Saturday will be Brother Timothy, who is the head Christian brother, the provincial of Brother Brian's order, to come and really talk about what LaSallian, you know, spirituality is all about. So it should be very informative.
And you do a program called Spirituality TV. Tell us about that.
I do. Well, this show really came out of the Institute for Spirituality. I was going, and I've been going every year. Nobody's gotten more out of this than I have, because you just got to show up, and you'll be fed well. And so I decided, gee, there's so few people that can come out, so let's put some of this on. So I'd been on community television before and done a lot of that. So for the last 13 and a half years, we've been doing Spirituality TV and bringing it to people who can't come to the program and other people that we can't have in the summer that can come out. And it airs currently every Monday night at 7 p.m. on Comcast Cable Channel 16 and also on Thursday mornings at 9 a.m. And if you don't have cable, they do stream it. It also airs in Albuquerque, Rio Rancho, and Los Alamos. So I believe Albuquerque and Los Alamos do stream their programming. So if you can find them, Google them up, those TV shows. I know it's Saturday night at 9 p.m. currently out of Albuquerque, and that's Google up quote unquote Channel 27 and you'll find it. And I think Los Alamos is Pac 8 TV.
But basically, Spirituality TV. Brother Brian, you're a Catholic brother. What do brothers do? What's your job?
Yeah, well, my job is to teach. That's what the brothers of the Christian schools do. However, there are other brothers who do all kinds of other things, and that's would be sort of like what the Franciscans do. Right? We owe a lot to the Franciscans. Many of the people who worked here were brothers because Francis himself never became a priest. So there's a movement among the brothers, even in America, to be more brotherly and less priestly.
Officially priests?
No, I'm just a brother.
Yeah.
And in that sense, it's just a brother because I don't do any of the sacraments. See, this is the order, the ordination of the priest, to provide for the people the kinds of help that Jesus brought us for our soul directly. And rather than do that, I spend my time teaching.
And so is your main venue the Santa Fe Institute for Spirituality?
No, the main venue is the College of Santa Fe, where I teach philosophy, psychology, and then during the summer, theology.
And if people would like to find out more information on the Santa Fe Institute for Spirituality and the work of both of you, how do they do so?
Yeah, well, the simple way would be to phone us, area code 505-473-6390. Then we also have a website. Right, that's going to be sfi.org.
Sfis.org.
Sfis, right, .org. Right. And it's also possible to get to us by email, and then you can use snail mail as well at 1600 St. Michael.
And I want to thank you both very much for being with us, Brother Brian Dubowski, who is a Christian brother at the College of Santa Fe and president of the Santa Fe Institute for Spirituality, and Bill O'Donnell with the same institute and the producer and host of Spirituality TV. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks for having us, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds and Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Hasta la vista. Ciao.